Well, thank you, Johnny, for this generous introduction. and thank you also for this invitation. And thank you to all for coming this afternoon to listen to me. I don't know, as you may know, I am, as Bernie said previously, I'm an anthropologist. I'm not an historian or a political scientist. And I have a particular way to tackle things, particularly, in that case, post-colonial studies. Excuse me for my broken English. French has got a reputation to be awkward with foreign languages, and in this respect, I'm certainly very French. So the title of my presentation is, as Bernie said, Can Africa Be Disconnected from the West? By the West, I will contend here that this notion, West, stands for, is equated with Europe. West is equated with Europe. Can Africa be disconnected? It refers to the title of my book, L'Occident décroché, disconnected, could be a translation that fit with décroché. It could be also translated by unhooked. In my presentation or my paper, I will reflect on the distinction between the universality and the diversity of cultures through the question of whether Africa can be disconnected from the West or from Europe. I will base my demonstration on the example of the Council for the Development of Research in Social Sciences in Africa, better known under its French acronym, CODESRIA, an organization based in Dakar in Senegal. This organization only recruits and supports African researchers and aims to define uniquely and exclusively African paradigm in social sciences. Thus, I will examine the arguments raised by the major authors who have participated in the debates that have marked this institution. My aim is not so much to elucidate whether it is possible or not to disconnect African philosophy or thought from Western philosophy or thought, but to show that the question should, in reality, be posed differently. In my book, L'Occident décroché, the disconnected West or the unhooked West, on the issue of African philosophy or thought, I endeavored to look into CODESRIA as an alternative production site. In other words, as an institution that claims to elaborate a scientific paradigm that is different from the Western paradigm. In this effort, I tried to lend an open ear to the researchers, intellectuals, and thinkers working in this institution. Space and time does not allow me to expand on the details of the debates that have taken place within CODESRIA since its creation in 1973, and I will limit myself to outlining the main points of these debates. A number of African philosophers, researchers, and thinkers have voiced their opinions during the debates that have taken place within CODESRIA in the last 30 years, thus highlighting what is perhaps a unique example of public space on the African continent, at least in Habermas terms. Some of the most outstanding figures include the French-Egyptian economist Samir Amin, who is well-known, worldwide-known, the philosopher from Benin, Paulin Untonji, the Ugandan political scientist Mahmoud Mamdani, who is now teaching at Columbia University in the Department of Political Science, the economist from Malawi, Tandika Mkandawire, who is now in Geneva at the United Nations, the political scientist from Cameroon, Achille Mbembe, who is well known too, worldwide known, the Senegalese historians Ousmane Kahn and Mamadou Diouf, who is now teaching at Columbia University at the Institute of African Studies, the Senegalese philosopher Souleymane Bachir Diagne, who is now teaching also at Columbia University and the Department of French and Francophone Studies, the sociologist Ayesha Iman, Amina Mama, and Fatou Sow, and so on. There are several other figures, but I can't mention all of them. But curiously, and beyond particular idiosyncrasies, the main points of disagreement between these intellectuals were not, at least in the first phase of the debates, over the opposition between an African thought or philosophy on the one hand and a Western thought or philosophy on the other, but over something totally different. As a result, the fundamental conflict within the institution was between two main trends, one represented by Francophone researchers and the other by Anglophone researchers, although we will see that the conflict also involved a divide or a clash of a different type. It is in the context of this conflict that the search for a uniquely or exclusively African paradigm in social sciences took place, a paradigm which in reality is all but uniquely or exclusively African. Going back to the creation of Codesria in 1973, one notices that although its first executive secretary, the highest position in the organization, Samir Amin, was a Francophone, he was rapidly replaced by an Anglophone, Abdallah Bouja from Nigeria, who was in office from 1975 to 1985, and Abdallah Bouja was in turn replaced by another Anglophone from Malawi, Tandika Mkandawire, who also served a 10-year term from 1986 to 1996. This long Anglophone domination was eventually countered only because French-speaking researchers had long been paving the way for the arrival of French-speaking political scientist Achille Mbembe from Cameroon. Achille Mbembe's appointment as executive secretary in 1996 created a stir within Codesria, so different were the approaches of the two trends. But since the end of Achille Mbembe's term in 2000, one has witnessed a return in force of the Anglophones with the arrival of the Nigerian political scientist Odebayo Olokushi, who has been in charge from 2001 to 2008, followed by Ebrima Sall from Gambia, who is the present executive secretary. Firstly, it is to be noted that for a long time, Anglophones dominated this institution at the expense of not only Francophones, but also Lusophones and Arabophones, these four languages being the four main working languages of the Côte d'Ivoire. Secondly, it is important to stress that the sometimes violent confrontation between Anglophones and Francophones also corresponds to conflicting approaches between the two groups to both philosophy and social sciences. The Anglophone trend is dominated by two figures, Tambikam Kandawire and Mahmoud Mamdani. The former expressed his wish to define an autonomous African knowledge, which for him implied a preliminary criticism not only of Western Africanism, but also of the behavior of Africanists in Africa, especially their relations with their African colleagues, marked by condescension and paternalism. This refers to the period 1930-1960. Things have changed from 1960. Mahmoud Mamdani, on the other hand, developed a theory which sees the contemporary African state as a legacy of the colonial state, a conception which is poles apart from that of French political scientist Jean-François Bayard, especially in his book The State in Africa, which has been published in France in 1989. Jean-François Bayard sees the corruption of the state in Africa, which he calls the politics of the belly, as a purely African characteristic. It's purely culturally African. Both Kandawire and Mamdani have taken a clear Marxist-Leninist and anti-imperialist stance, which contrasts with that of leading authors of the Francophone trend, such as the Senegalese historian Mamadou Diouf, who teaches now at Columbia University in New York, or the political scientist Achille Mbembe, who teaches now in South Africa and also in the United States at the University of California at Irvine. The positions of Mamadou Diouf or Achille Mbembe belong, in my opinion, to the populist type of political science and studies, which tackles social actors from the bottom and are thus inspired by the work of Jean-François Bayard, already mentioned, and to some extent, in my opinion, by the ideas of American anthropologist James Scott, and especially in his book called The Weapons of the Weak, which has been published in 1985. In any event, it is important to note that this debate of ideas between an Anglophone Marxist and anti-imperialist old guard and a populist Francophone young guard is not specifically African. The theoretical ideas and references associated with the advocates of both trends are not strictly African, even though these positions are defended by Africans living in Africa or outside the continent. The characteristic of this debate has a direct impact on the question of the existence or non-existence of a purely African thought or philosophy. But as has already been said, one debate of ideas may hide another, and the second debate involves players that were not directly associated with the intellectual life or history of the Codestria. So now I'm going to deal with the nature and stakes of the second debate, which is hidden behind the first debate. The confrontation between anti-imperialist Marxists and populist political scientists seems to conceal, in my opinion, a second debate pertaining to the relation between African thought, history, and philosophy, and to the question of the distinction between oral and written traditions. In this confrontation, two clear-cut positions are opposed to each other, though there are some bridges between them. On one hand, some authors establish a link between the existence of an African thought, history, or philosophy, and the written tradition, regardless of whether it is of Western, that is colonial, or Arabo-Islamic origin. On the other hand, some intellectuals defend the idea of the autonomy of African thought and philosophy in relation to written traditions, whatever they may be. The first group includes the Congolese-American philosopher Valentin Moudimbe, who, in his book, a famous book, which has received Melville Moscovitz Award, The Invention of Africa, which has been published in 1988. So, Valentin Moudimbe defended in this book the idea that the perception or the apprehension that we, meaning both Western and African scholars, may have of Africa is closely linked to what he calls colonial library, namely the vision of Africa conveyed by explorers, missionaries, colonial administrators, and/or ethnologists. Closely associated with this position are Ghanaian-American philosopher, who teaches now at Princeton University, Kwame Anthony Appiah, especially in his book In My Father's House, published in 1992, and Senegalese historian Ousmane Kahn, who teaches now at Columbia University in the Department of Political Science. Ousmane Kahn has expressed the idea that it is important to take full account of non-Europhone intellectual, that is, those who express themselves in Arabic or use the Arabic alphabet to transcribe African languages, what is called ajami, the way to use Arabic alphabet to transcribe either African languages or Middle East languages, and so forth. In order, Ousmane Kahn want to stress the importance of the existence of a true, what you call a true African enlightenment in his text published by Codestria, non-European intellectual. Allegedly, the existence of this African enlightenment forbids one to see the triumph of reason in 18th century Europe as a unique event in history. Finally, the last member of this trend of thought is the Colombia-based Senegalese philosopher Souleymane Bachir Diagne from Senegal, who, like Ousmane Kahn, is preoccupied by the place, he stresses the place of the Arabo-Islamic thought and philosophy, which is called in Arabic falsafa. So he's preoccupied by the place that the Arabo-Islamic thought and philosophy occupy in the African thought and by the impossibility of not taking it into account when it comes to establishing the conditions of possibility of an African philosophy. Poles apart from this conception are philosophers and scholars like Paulin Hountongi, the philosopher from Benin, and Mamadou Diouf, the political scientist from Senegal, who, as noted earlier, defend within their respective discipline, philosophy and history, the idea of the autonomy of African philosophy and thought in relation to written tradition, whatever they may be. Paulin Hountongi, in the second phase of his career, during the first phase, he criticized the very notion of African philosophy, but during his second phase, he defended the idea of the existence of African, what he called African endogenous knowledges, and even of a wholly native and autonomous African, what he called African science. This earned him criticism from some of his African colleagues, notably from Suleiman Bachir Diagne and from the Congolese philosopher, who is now also Minister for Defense in Congo-Brazzaville, Charles Bowell. Mamadou Diouf, the Senegalese historian, challenges Valentin Moudimbe and his colonial library by claiming the existence of a history which was existing after him before the state and the writing, that is a history which is produced by the people and for the people, even if these people, or rather different communities that make it, are increasingly fragmented entities. For this author, the idea is to promote an oral and ethnic history testifying of the tremors that have shaken contemporary African nation states. However, in my opinion, this position is of a mainly subtractive nature. In effect, as a matter of fact, in order to define a thought, a tradition, or an oral history, it is indeed necessary to first establish the existence of a written tradition, after which, at the end of a long featuring process, an oral legacy remains. From then on, the question is to know whether this legacy, endogenous knowledge, oral history and tradition, is truly autonomous or alternative. It is easy to demonstrate that history, tradition or oral thought often bears the mark of a form of writing, whether it be European, that is colonial, or Arabo-Islamic, and that it is the same for many types of supposed endogenous knowledges. Geomancy, for instance, which is set as an example by Paulin Hountongi. But in reality, there are too many people now. Stop. But in reality, this question is likely to shift again, because what matters in the end is to know whether there is an epistemic homology between an African set on the one end and an European or Arabo-Islamic set on the other. Is it necessary to start from the written tradition to consider the oral tradition? In this respect, we have to consider the notion of oral literature, or in French, orature. Or is the oral tradition of a different nature? Is the function of African traditions, epics to tell history? Do they have the value of chronicles? Or, as we shall see later, are they about something totally different, theories of power, for example. Similarly, the question arises of the need to establish whether African proverbs, sayings, and aphorisms really testify of the existence of a genuine African philosophy, as explained by some African philosophers, or whether they are not rather the expression of a wisdom of nations, of an ambient conformity. Of course, in accordance with a phenomenological aim, one can always, as Suleiman Bashir Diagne points out, give any oral narrative a philosophical form, but the written product, even if it is the work of an African philosopher, is nonetheless of Western origin, since all African philosophers were trained in the West or in a Western fashion. And this sends us back to the previous problem. Here lies the very problem of the existence of a native philosophy or anthropology. Who has the initiative? Who shapes, transcribes African philosophies? European or Western-trained philosophers such as Placide Temples with a Bantu philosophy, Marcel Griaul with Conversations with Ogote Meli, or Kwame Wiredu, the Ghanaian philosopher, with Cultural, Universal, and Particulars. Kwame Wiredu having been trained as a Western philosopher. The presence absence of writing in what is perceived as an African oral text signals the existence of an aporia of writing in the very question of the existence of an African history of philosophy. In this regard, it seems hardly a coincidence that almost all African prophetisms include the invention of some form of writing, or that philosophers try to find equivalents or substitute to writing or philosophy, for instance in African sculpture, like Suleiman Bashir Diagne referring, for instance, to Leopold Sédar Senghor's work. Is it not indeed in the absent books that it struggles to invent that lies the truth of Africa perceived as the continent of lack? But is it not essential to shift the question once again if we want to clear the aporia in which we find ourselves when trying to define the conditions of possibility of an African philosophy? Indeed, does this reasoning in terms of a binary opposition, Western philosophy versus African philosophy, not have more drawbacks than advantages? Does it not lead us on the hazardous path of cultural and antagonisms, of clashes of civilization, according to the expression of Samuel Huntington in his book The Clash of Civilization, published in 1997? Is it really necessary to continentalize, culturalize thought in the fashion of Dipesh Chakrabarty? The Indian historian from Chicago, who suggests provincializing Europe, that is to make it swallow its pride by treating it like any other cultural area. Like many post-colonial authors, Chakrabarty disputes Europe's claim to rule the world on the basis of human rights, while it is responsible for serious crimes in history, major crimes in history like the slave trade and colonization. This position is at the core, in my opinion, of post-colonial studies. But does the resolve to continentalize thought not lead to a sort of culturalization of the world? Is it really necessary to culturalize thought and philosophies by sealing them into ethnic boxes, Western, African, Amerindian, Indian, Chinese philosophies, etc., at the risk of impeding the understanding of contacts, borrowings, influences, or even what the Anglophones that you call commonalities, that is the existence of universal features. From this point of view, I don't think the issue is to know whether Africa, the African thought or philosophy, can or must be disconnected from Europe, from Western thought or philosophy. Africa, Europe, or any other geographic, intellectual, or philosophic continent are mere intellectual constructions that tend to harden their identities when they feel threatened. This is particularly the case of Europe for the time being. The idea of a Europe whose identity is allegedly based on Christian culture and religion, in particular, is a purely contemporary invention because it ignores the ancient presence of Jews, Muslims, Africans, and many other peoples and religions on its territory. To conclude, I would like to refer to an author, a philosopher, who is a major source of inspiration for mainly postcolonial authors, namely Michel Foucault. Michel Foucault deconstructed philosophy, particularly 16th and 17th political philosophy, and it is on this point that I would like to dwell for a moment. Indeed, for him, for Michel Foucault, the political philosophy of natural right and the philosophy of contract, such as one can find it in Machiavelli's Grotius, Hobbes, and Pufendorf's works, are only a legitimation of royal sovereignty. In Society Must Be Defended, which has been published in English in 2004, La Société, Il faut défendre la société in French, published in 1997, he distinguishes between what he calls the theory of the war of the two races, created in the 16th century by Boulainvilliers and taken up later in the 19th century by liberal historians like Augustin Thierry and François Guizot, before providing Karl Marx with a model for the class struggle, and political philosophy. So it distinguishes the theory or the model of the pattern of the war of the two races with political philosophy. For Michel Foucault, these two models or patterns correspond to two types of legacy, that of Rome for political philosophy and that of Jerusalem for the war of the two races. In the history of France, the latter model or patterns makes a paradigmatic distinction between two layers or two stocks of population. First, the invading France coming from Germania, from Germany, who were the ancestors of nobility, the aristocracy, on the one hand, and the native Gauls or Gallo-Romans, who were the ancestors of the commoners, that is, the tiers état in French. The same dualism can be found in the history of England with the invading Normans, ancestors of the aristocracy, and the native Anglo-Saxons, ancestors of the people who were overcome in 1066 at the Battle of Hastings, as you know. However, Michel Foucault is not aware that the war of the two races model or pattern, which is analyzed in purely European context, Michel Foucault has never been interested by other cultures, exotic cultures, This model can be transposed to other regions of the world, particularly Africa. Indeed, what is the political model, political pattern? What is the theory of power which is most widely spread in Africa, especially in the Sudano-Sahelian West Africa, a region where I have worked, and so far has worked. Among the Mossi, the Bambara, and other population, but all over in Africa, and as a matter of fact, it is this model that differentiates between conquerors, people of power, on the one hand, and the native people of the earth and masters of the ritual on the other. This theory of the war of the two races, this theory of power enables us to understand and reflect on what has been labeled as joking relationship by anthropologists, but which in reality are mainly political pacts or oral contracts that sanction power struggles and power relations of force between distinct groups, that is, clans and lineages. This is the basic West African and even African political theory. To conclude, should we not see this binary distinction, conquerors, people of power, versus natives, people of the earth, as a structure that transcends continents, that transcends the cultural and possibly philosophical areas of today? Is this type of distinction not good to think, to borrow Lévi-Strauss' expression, beyond cultural differences? Is it not a way of escaping grievous questioning, which, as we have seen, consists of locking thoughts and philosophies in narrow geographic and cultural framings? While the history of humanity is made, in my opinion, of exchanges and movements of all sorts, of both material goods and thoughts, withdrawals appear mainly as identity tensions, which are often not devoid of any political ulterior motives. From this point of view, Africa does not have to be reconnected to or disconnected from other continents. I would argue that real emancipatory thought consists precisely of thinking beyond continents, beyond the inappropriately named cultural areas. To return to Michel Foucault, and it will be my conclusion, it does not matter much to know whether the schema of the war of the two races is Semit, Western, or African. What matters is that it be common to the two or the three groups. Thank you very much.